Greetings, this is Pastor David Bass at New Geneva Orthodox Presbyterian Church with a moment of truth where we challenge you to think through an important issue of life and faith. And today, who has done more to express to the general American public traditional family? Would it be A, Pope Francis, B, Billy Graham, or C, Phil Robertson of Duck Dynasty? Well, not to disparage Pope Francis or Reverend Graham, who have, in their own ways, expressed eloquently the traditional biblical family, but I submit to you, most of America hasn't heard of them or heard them either, but they have heard Phil Robertson, and he has done this plainly and frankly, hasn't he? And I'd be remiss as a pastor and conservative in passing up this opportunity to articulate the Christian argument for traditional marriage and against same-sex marriage, all other forms of marriage for that matter, too. As politically incorrect as this view may be in today's culture, Phil Robertson is right, isn't he? And I quote him now from his interview in Gentleman's Quarterly. He said, "Start with homosexual behavior and just morph out from there. Bestiality, sleeping around with this woman and that woman and that woman and those men. Don't be deceived," he went on to say, and then he quotes from 1 Corinthians. He says, "Neither the adulterers, the idolaters, the male prostitutes, the homosexual offenders, the greedy, the drunkards, the slanderers, the swindlers, they won't inherit the kingdom of God. Don't deceive yourself. It's not right," unquote. Well, sure has raised a firestorm, hasn't it? It's as if someone's thrown a hand grenade in a hornet's nest. But how politically correct, I would say, to the media, how lemming-like from those who should know better. Phil Robertson has simply laid out the case for these things in a blue-collar fashion, without frills, without affectation, right? Let me see if I might be able to expand on these places by making 3 points, and I'd like to make 3 points concerning the gay agenda. They include a theological argument, a demographic argument, and a cultural argument. Let me take them one at a time. First of all, the theological argument. Say that 10 times fast. First of all, there is one biblical model for family and marriage. You can accept this or reject this, indeed, as a matter of true religion or false superstition, but there is a theological argument to be made from the Bible, and that is there is one biblical model for family and marriage. Since the creation of the world, God has made man in his image from Genesis chapter 5. He says, when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God, that is the image of God. Male and female, he created them, and he blessed them and named them man when they were created, unquote. Well, there's the biblical formula here. One male, one female constitute the whole image of God. Nowhere in Scripture is the image of God put forward as two men or two women, nor is it one man and plural wives, or one man and a beast, or one man and a beast. It is always and only one man that is a husband and one woman that is a wife. Any other configuration, by definition, disfigures the image of God in man. And under this main point, there are 3 subordinate points to be made, too, that are linked very closely to it. And first of all, A, under 1, that is, the covenant of marriage underlies this principle. There is a covenant, God's economy, covenant of marriage underlies this principle. And what verse is it that you hear quoted in Christian marriage services all the time? It is, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall hold fast to his wife," cleave to his wife, "and the two shall become one flesh." Yes. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. "What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate," unquote. Marriage for centuries has been between one man and one woman precisely because of the words of God in Genesis and Jesus in the Gospels. These are not merely nice words to say at a solemn service. No, they reflect the image of God in man. Note with me, a man, singular, shall leave his mother and hold fast to his wife, that is singular. The biblical math is inevitable. The two, one man plus one woman, shall become one flesh. This one flesh relationship is emblematic of the one image of God that man constitutes. And I would submit to you, it is beautiful. It is ecstatic. It is profound. The sexual union physically pictures this one flesh relationship. The one name, too, the wife takes, pictures the single identity of this one flesh relationship. So, When Phil Robertson compares with righteous disgust the difference between placing the male reproductive organ into, on the one hand, a man's anus, excuse my graphic, but he was graphic too, wasn't he? And then on the other hand, into a woman's vagina with righteous approval, well, Phil Robertson is just affirming God's covenantal order, isn't he? You can understand the gay community's fierce hysterical response to this graphic statement of the facts, since it does clearly picture not only the beauty of heterosexual union, but also the ugly, unnatural nature of the homosexual union. B, secondly, under indeed the theological argument, the covenant of marriage pictures the union of Christ and his church. The covenant of marriage pictures the union of Christ and his church. How many people married today realize this, that their marriage is larger than just the two persons who compose it? Now, I've counseled and married dozens of couples, and I hear something like this repeatedly. Our love is just between us, Pastor. It's about us and no one else. I call this the Romeo and Juliet syndrome. It's not about just you and your spouse. No, it wasn't so in Romeo and Juliet, and it isn't in real life either. If you examine the Bible, you begin to see that a husband and wife are living out in miniature the bond between Christ and his church as well. This is true whether you want it to be or not, dear listener. It's true whether you are aware of it or not. It is true. You may scoff or scorn or cast skepticism upon this idea, but nevertheless, it is wired into the very fabric of the institution of marriage itself. It is a wondrous mystery that is beautiful and profound when you contemplate as God intended you to contemplate this institution. The Apostle Paul says in Ephesians, he says, this mystery is profound. That is the mystery of marriage between a man and a woman. This mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband, unquote, from the Apostle Paul. The mystery of marriage refers to Christ and his church. The husband pictures Christ as the head of the church. The husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, Paul says. And the wife pictures Christ's body, the church. As Paul says, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands, unquote. So, together, one man representing Christ as the head and one woman representing his bride as the body, these symbolize Christ and his church. This is the model. So, can you see how anything else distorts it? Two men in marriage are a disfigurement of that image. Two women in marriage are a rejection of this model. One man plus plural wives destroys this model. The profound mystery is by definition one man, one woman, symbolizing the one Christ and the one church. And God, make no mistake about this, God will hold every couple responsible to their fidelity to this model. And then thirdly, under the theological argument for traditional biblical marriage, the third theological argument is the one thing that God seeks from marriage is godly offspring. This is a corollary, is it not? The one thing that God seeks from marriage is godly offspring. Now in marriage, you and I are, as husbands and wives, we find a joy in one another, don't we? Companionship, we benefit from reliance on our spouses. But God also has his own purposes too. And I quote now from the prophet Malachi. The prophet Malachi says, did he not make them one? That is, did not God make husband and wife one? With a portion of the Spirit in their union. And what was this one God seeking? Godly offspring. Godly offspring God is seeking. The prophet goes on to say, so guard yourselves in your spirit and let none of you be faithless to the wife of your youth, unquote. Oh, how can godly offspring possibly be produced in a marital model like those in the gay or lesbian marriages, which are unfruitful by definition when considered in themselves? Malachi, in speaking to the leaders of Israel, he affirms this one flesh union of a man and a woman. Did God not make them one, that is, one man and one woman, into one flesh? Out of the two, then, come one flesh, that is, from that union come offspring. Note also the holiness of the union. He says a portion of the Holy Spirit is in their union. So, I always quiz my premarital couples as to what their expectations are in marriage. There are always many in a relationship, aren't there? Some are very realistic. Couples expect companionship, and hopefully they find it. Perhaps a satisfying sex life, and I pray that they do find that as well. Perhaps a growing family, too, with kids and all the closeness and intimacy that that involves. But some are not so realistic, some of those expectations. Sometimes I hear a husband say that she expects her wife to be sexy every minute of the day, and when you've got four kids milling around you and the flu, it's a little hard to be sexy 24/7, isn't it? Well, some wives also, they want a husband who can maybe sense every need without me saying a word. That's unrealistic. Or maybe a husband who can buy me new things right away like my dad. One prospective wife expected that from her husband. And that's just not realistic when you're starting out. Well, in counseling these couples, I always try to give a sense that not only you, but also the God who made you has expectations too. And that is godly offspring. Both of these elements are crucial. Offspring that are godly. He seeks godly offspring, not just churning out kids willy-nilly without regard to their spiritual development. They must be nurtured to love the Lord their God with all their heart, mind, and strength. But tell me, dear listener, how is a homosexual couple taken as a unit? How are they to do this? They cannot, by definition, produce offspring. And even if it were somehow possible to do it, they would not be godly because of the nature of the union. Well, secondly, these are the theological arguments I would make. And you can accept them or reject them, especially if you're a Christian and you believe in the Bible, then you must take them seriously. But you can't deny the next two arguments because they are demographic and cultural. Let me make a demographic argument for traditional marriage here. First of all, you just heard the theological argument. Number two, when the biblical model for marriage is abandoned, a downward demographic spiral ensues. When the biblical model for marriage is abandoned, a downward demographic spiral ensues. It's an unalterable fact. Let me ask you, when someone says to you, what's wrong with homosexual couples marrying? And what if they move in next to you? What skin off your nose is it, right? How do you answer? Well, demography is the study of societal fluctuations in births, deaths, and population shifts. And gay marriage has an impact on demography. Any society that encourages or passively tolerates homosexual marriage has to deal with this. They will see an ineluctable decline in birth rates, especially as gay culture grows. It will eventually contribute in part to the decline, perhaps even the death of that society. It's true for a number of reasons. Two of them, let me point them out to you. Number one, under the demographic argument. First of all, gay and lesbian marriages are by definition unfruitful when considered in themselves. Demographically, are they not? They are by definition unfruitful when considered in themselves. That is, try as they might, the union of Adam and Steve, that is a homosexual marriage, will issue only in dryness. And try as they might, even the union of Eve and Genevieve, that is a lesbian marriage, will issue only in an unfulfilled, unfertilized ovum. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered cannot self-propagate, can they? It is biologically impossible for such unions to be demographically productive in and of themselves, unaffected by an outside source or even. They cannot produce pagan offspring, much less godly offspring. There are, of course, child-rearing options for these couples. That's not to say there are not child-rearing options for these couples. The Dr. Scher Fertility Clinic Center for Reproductive Medicine, they list several options available to gay couples. There might be adoption, for example, foster care perhaps, in vitro fertilization with donor sperm, perhaps donor egg in vitro fertilization with surrogacy for male couples, or maybe traditional surrogacy for male couples, or donor in utero insemination, and then perhaps even embryo adoption. These are all options that Dr. Scher Fertility Clinic Center offers. But besides, they also caution you. They say besides the steep legal hurdles that many of these options face in many states, like adoption, there are steep legal hurdles against adoption in many states. Well, there is the ultimate Darwinian hurdle, I would submit to you, and that is reproductive inertia. With gay couples, with lesbian couples, there is reproductive inertia. Even if we were to double the number of options available to them, all the wonders of reproducing our kind, isn't it? It's marvelous just to be married and to reproduce children, to have a large family, just because God's desire is for godly offspring. Even if we were to double the number of options available to gay couples, they have little or no desire to do so. There is reproductive inertia. Currently, 33% of lesbian and 20% of gay households have children being reared in them. Now, it's important to note that most of these are from previous heterosexual relationships, too. 33% of lesbian, 20% of gay households have children in them, but most of them are from previous heterosexual relationships. Only 50%, for example, even then, apart from this, even only 50% of lesbian women currently express even a desire to parent. It's not that they are parenting. They don't even generally have the desire. 50% of lesbian women, and they have the wounds. They have the places where, indeed, children are gestated. There simply is no incentive to create offspring with their own equipment, much less godly offspring. So that is the first, indeed, argument under the demographic one. That is, gay and lesbian marriages are by definition unfruitful when considered in themselves, largely not because they don't have the equipment they do, but there is indeed reproductive inertia amongst homosexual couples. Secondly, under the demographic argument, gay and lesbian marriages by definition subtract productive parents from the pool. Do they not? By definition. Every gay couple subtracts two potential husbands and their sperm and their seed and the children that they would spawn. And every lesbian couple subtracts two potential wives and the children that their wombs would generate. Isn't that true? Make no mistake about this, dear listener. This fact has a profound impact on the demographic future of the United States of America. Currently, the United States of America has a birth rate that is below replacement level. Do you understand the consequences? When the United States has a birth rate below replacement level, and generally demographers say that anything under 2.1 children per woman on an average, when a nation has a birth rate of 2.1 children per woman that constitute that society, well, it is considered sub-replacement. And the United States of America currently has a birth rate of 1.89 children per woman in the United States. It's not as bad as other nations. And to further expand on this and to consult other sources here, I would suggest that you look at the book How Civilizations Die by David P. Goldman, published in 2011, one of the most important books published that year as far as I'm concerned. Well, if this is true, if a nation falls below replacement level in its birth rates, well, then eventually, all other things being equal, any given population would dwindle into insignificance and perhaps even extinguish itself. So, while only one factor in this equation, and I want to underscore this with you, gay and lesbian marriages, especially as the culture grows and increases in mushrooms, while only one factor in this equation, other things like abortion or the feminization of men or the decline of religious faith, these kinds of things Goldman points out, it is the expansion and contraction of gay marriages. They will have an impact on this figure. The more, it only stands to reason, the more reproducing couples you have in any given society, the greater expansion of its population. What would it be, the demographic world in the United States, if any given individual from a homosexual couple instead married a partner from a lesbian couple, settled down and raised a family? This used to be, even the marginal gay men and women in our culture used to do that, didn't they? Until there was societal pressure for them to do so. And oftentimes they evened out and indeed did raise normal, healthy families. And the results would be exponential, wouldn't it? If this were the case, multiple children from these marriages would marry and create multiple children and further marriages in an expanding family tree. That would mean a growth of the American population rather than a shrinking or withering of it. But as it stands, there will be an inverse exponential collapse. We subtract from the potential number of population those which these couples would otherwise produce. Dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners, our society gets the future that it deserves. Now, I understand that this demographic argument is considerably more abstract than ones usually put forward by either side. It doesn't have the emotional force of an argument like we only want our civil rights under the Constitution to marry. Or perhaps that lesbian and gay people, they have a right to be happy, don't we? We can't help how God made us. These are all emotional arguments that don't have the emotional. And my argument here, the demographic one, doesn't have the emotional impact, but doesn't make it any less real. The acceptance, growth, and expansion of gay and lesbian marriage will contribute to a demographic death spiral in the United States of America. Thirdly, there's a cultural argument, too. First of all, let me point out that when the biblical model for marriage is abandoned, a cultural death spiral also ensues. It's a corollary of the demographic argument. When I hear the emotional appeal, what does it hurt, right, if a gay couple marries, even moves in next door to you, how does that any skin off your nose? Well, I immediately respond, it spells the death of a life culture. In the end, it is impossible for a culture of life to coexist with a culture of death. There is an implicit conflict between straight and gay cultures. And this implicit conflict goes to the heart of what culture is, for that matter. Edward Taylor has a traditional definition of culture. He was an anthropologist from the 19th century, and he defined culture as the complex whole of belief, art, morals, law, and custom acquired by man as a member of society, unquote. And I just paraphrase that. I say it's the best to live for and the best way to get there that we've learned yet. Another just thumbnail definition of culture, if you will. But this idea of the complex whole of all that we are and love, it wants to be communicated to the next generation. And it's the impulse of humanity. It's the impulse of culture. And it's no less true of lesbian and gays than it is of straight culture. It is the nature of culture to be preserved and protected and propagated to the next generation. As Goldman puts it in his book, he says, and I quote, "Individual human existence looks forward to the continuation of the culture that nourishes, sustains, and transmits our contribution to future generations," unquote. Lesbian and gay culture has within it as well the impulse to be continued as much as straight culture does. This is where the conflict occurs. How is lesbian and gay culture transmitted, huh? And what of lesbian and gay culture is communicated, the substance of it? Well, note with me two things. First of all, the very subjects of the next gay generation must be recruited from this straight generation, doesn't it? That's a cultural fact that many gay culturalists must recognize. The very subjects of the next gay generation must be recruited from this straight generation. Have you ever thought about this, dear listener? It's not a passive question of mere toleration. How do lesbians and gays propagate? We've already observed that self-propagation is impossible or marginal. By definition, homosexual and lesbian marriages are unfruitful. Whence tomorrow's next lesbian and gay generation? And only one place. It must be plucked from despised breeders. You are looked at, dear straight couple. You are looked at as mere fodder for future gay and lesbian predations. Where else are they going to find their subjects for the next generation? Cabbage patches? Storks? No, it's from breeders. Heterosexual couples, you are the ones who produce children consistently and prolifically. You and your family are the only and exclusive fruitful harvest fields from which subjects may be harvested. If the lesbian and gay culture is to continue to the next generation, it must entice, capture, and train an army of socially conditioned children who to become lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgendered. This is why you see lesbian and gay apologists stridently advocate for the strategies by which they do recruit that next generation. Well, for example, the lesbian and gay commandeer the school systems, even as they behold Common Core In the name of tolerance, they indoctrinate the minds of the bulk of straight society to passively accept lesbian and gay culture while aggressively suggesting to vulnerable, weak adolescents that they are lesbian and gay. It's hip. It's cool. There's an air about it. How many marginal kids would go straight if indeed the pressure was not on to be hip and to be cool and to have the suggestion planted in those confused, growing adolescent bodies that are flowing with hormones and questions? How many would go straight if they were not enticed by Common Core by the name of tolerance and indoctrination, huh? The lesbian and gay community commandeer the school systems. Also, they co-opt the culture, do they not? Why are gay characters portrayed sympathetically in television sitcoms and in movies? Why do musicians increasingly make out with one another and sing queer music? Why do news commentators, political pundits now openly advocate for tolerance and acceptance? Lesbian and gay culture also increasingly criminalizes dissent, does it not? When all else fails, you shut down or shout down dissent. You pass city ordinances against discrimination. You protest hysterically against any opinion that disagrees. You lobby for legislation that criminalizes any political opinion that would dissent from doctrinaire opinion. Lesbian and gay culture must be free to suggest, to cultivate, to persuade, to entice, to glorify their culture and their lifestyle if indeed they are going to sustain themselves to the next generation. Because there was nowhere else to go but to the breeders for the subjects of their next generation. Well, lesbian and gay culture is by nature derivative, needing the breeder upon which to draw to constitute its next cultural generation. Isn't that not true? Well, also then, lesbian and gay culture also behaves like all cultures, in accordance with its own need to survive. Cultures wish and desire to propagate, do they not? Straight mainstream culture is so naive. We assume that gay and lesbian couples merely want to be left alone to live their lives in peace and fulfillment when, just like any ordinary heterosexual couple, right? How naive. I quote now from Paula Edelbrick, from the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund. She says, and I quote, "Being queer is more than setting up house, sleeping with a person of the same gender, and seeking state approval for doing so. Being queer means pushing the parameters of sex, sexuality, and family, and in the process transforming the very fabric of society." Unquote. Paula Edelbrick. Oh, how naive we are, dear fellow straight. You're being shepherded like a sheep for the slaughter. Like all cultures, lesbian and gay culture has the impulse to preserve, protect, and propagate itself, doesn't it? To transform the very fabric of society, as Ms. Edelbrick puts it. Well, the only alternative to growth and death and expansion, the only alternative to growth and expansion is death, isn't it? You're not busy being born as busy dying, as Dylan said. Well, like all cultures, they have this need to propagate and self-propagate, isn't it? Dear brother and sister, what are we to do? What is required to counter this and to indeed support the traditional marriage? What is required, I submit to you, is a complete spiritual reformation in the United States of America. First of all, the biblical model of marriage, one man, one woman. Christ is the beginning, middle, and end of our hope for redemption in these things. Only as we return to Him as our head will we as the body, the church, remain in fidelity to the model of marriage set before us. Put it out there. Make it clear. Put it out there for our culture and society to see. Anything else will bring judgment upon us as a people. Return to Christ, dear America, who is the bridegroom, and we the church, His spotless bride, that is. You, O Christian, you must stand firm and resolute. Put forward the biblical model for family. Do not be beguiled by the smooth talk and the lies of the lesbian and gay community. Oh, what harm does it do to have a gay couple living next door to you? You indeed now are armed with three arguments, one theological, one demographic, and one cultural. This is Pastor David Bass at New Geneva Orthodox Presbyterian Church. New Geneva meets for holy worship at 10 a.m. on Sunday morning at 101 4th Street on the corner of 4th and Boulevard. We invite you to call us for comments or further information, 523-0196. Once again, New Geneva meets for holy worship on Sunday morning, 10 a.m. at 101 4th Street on the corner of 4th and Boulevard. God bless you, and hold out that model of traditional Christian marriage.